Hello. Many of you have been tuning into our conversations for some time, and now we'd like the chance to get to tune into you. So we invite you to record a voice message letting us know what's on your mind and send it to us at info@insightmyanmar.org. We will keep all communication confidential unless, of course, you give us permission to share it, which we will happily do so in a future podcast episode. JC, welcome to Insight Myanmar podcast.
Well, yeah, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here. I'm excited to share my experience with you. Well, so yeah, I grew up in Yangon, in Seng, where the Karen community is, and then I left to Thailand, and but yeah, basically also to find better opportunity, and also it was because my dad was already in the Netherlands, and then to reunite with him as well in that sense. But yeah, in that time we couldn't because of some complication, and then my dad and my mom, they, you know, as in Myanmar, because of the economy, people don't usually live together, and then that brought me to continue living in Thailand, and I learned about, you know, moving in Thailand actually made me realize that in Burma we have like conflicts and civil war. When I was in Yangon, I did not know that at all. I never heard of that. You know, in our school, all the textbooks are propaganda, you know, like how the country is so good, and you know, that's what's ingrained in us. And then actually moving to like kind of like open my minds, because of, you know, like there are like a lot of refugee camps in Thailand and things like that, and that people have to flee the wars. And I think because me being a Karen as well make me you know, kind of get a bit angry, and then like, oh, that a lot of people do not know about this, but I'm sure like young people now knows because of the media exposure. But at that time, and then that actually made me want to, yeah, study some form of journalism or something. Then, yeah, I was doing this immigrant school called MHEP, and where people can get the GED from the U.S. the high school standard diploma. And then from there, I was able to go to, because then I have the degree, then I got to able, like the diploma, so I got to continue study in Bangkok in communications art, which is quite like the closest to journalism. But yeah, I didn't really end up doing journalism. But I end up doing some form of like communications, and then yeah, then after my degree, then I went back to Burma to, you know, to be part of the the development, the social change, you know, because the country got open and, you know, there were a lot of reforming things happening. So, yeah, I felt like it was a good time for me to go back as well after school.
Great. Thank you. There's so much there to explore. So you reference how when you were growing up in Burma, you weren't aware there was a civil war. You weren't aware there was conflict. And it was only when you got to Thailand that you were, that Burmese experience was reframed into understanding what you had come out of, and looking at it from a distance, you understood things you couldn't when you were there. I'm curious what it's like being a Karen, though, because we hear from Bamar people who are insulated in Bamar communities with Bamar propaganda and are scared of the propaganda that's coming from what the ethnics are doing. But you were from an ethnic community, and the Karens have been fighting the Bamar really since the beginning. The Civil War started in 1948 with the Karens rising up. And so how was it that being in a Karen community in Yangon, you weren't aware of the Karen-Bamar struggles and the wider ethnic struggles until you got to Thailand?
Yeah, I remember one thing that whenever I try to sing like national anthem at home, my mom would be like, "No, don't sing that." You know, it's like, "Why are you singing that?" You know, it's so Burmese. You know, it's so Burma, and I'll be like, "Well, why not? It's so very you know, and powerful, empowering, encouraging." So, as a kid, I think maybe it's a way of my mom telling me that something's going on, but I think like, yeah, nobody really talked about it, you know? I never knew that, yeah, nobody really talked about it. And then the adult would talk to each other, but not to the kids, you know? I'm not sure, maybe, you know, I think in your mom's like, "Oh, you're just a kid, so you don't need to know this stuff, that stuff," you know? But it's only one thing when I ever tried to, yeah, sing the national Burmese anthem, then my mom's like, "No, don't sing that. Stop," you know? And I was a bit rebellious. I was like, "No, I'm going to sing anyway." And and then when I went to Thailand, I was surprised, and it makes me wonder, wow, our ethnicity being oppressed so long, you know? And that also makes me angry, you know, that this is not fair, you know, and then they are not, we don't even know about this, you know, the Karen themselves, maybe me, like a young kid, you know. I'm sure a lot of young people also did not know about that back then, you know. And it just makes me feel like, yeah, maybe we don't talk, maybe the fears, you know, if people talked about it, that because they've been living under the military rules, right? That talking about something outside, like against them, or people know about it, probably not safe, even though maybe it might not put you in danger, because people have been living under this oppression for so long, the danger, or like if you do something, you would, there will be something, even something small, you know, there will be consequences. I think like people live in that fears for so long that they don't even dare to speak up on anything anymore, you know, or forgot to speak up. And these, yeah. Yeah, it just also made me realize that, you know.
So, I mean, that's an enormous sense of a burden of trauma that you're describing, and an intergenerational trauma that, again, goes back to the late 1940s. It's had a few ceasefires since then, but for the most part, it's been pretty consistent. And where you're not just talking about a rash of anger or a fear of something heightening up, but you're talking about a way of living life where you're managing or not managing, you know, this sense of trauma that you're just trying to get by. And so did you, as you navigated Karen communities and you were exploring your own anger and your own fear and your own Karen identity, did you feel like you were touching upon this sense of like communal trauma that wasn't being addressed by the wider community, or how would you describe it?
Yeah, I think in a way, but it's so, I don't know, I have this no identity sometimes, right? The things like I grew up in Yangon for so long, and in Thailand, the current community are also kind of different,
sure.
You know? And then you feel like, and then, I don't know, you feel like which one I belong to, you know? You feel like part of you, you have the responsibility for this kind of community, but at the same time, you also feel like for that kind of community. But then also, growing up far away from home for so long, also you, I feel like the identity got a bit fragmented, you know, like scattered. I feel like I picked up a little piece of here and there. Also, I feel like part of me also belong to Burma because my dad is Burmese actually, but I consider myself more Karen because I grew up in the Karen community and I always been raised in that way. So yeah, part of me also feel like, you know, I don't, and then I just take it on as it's a good question because I never know where should I stand fully, you know, and part of me feel like what the current has been gone through is also my, it's part of me, you know, it's part of my identity that I belong to this current group. And then we need, like, I feel like as a responsibility, like, you know, I identify to that the trauma as well. Where the Burma may have not have experienced as far as the Karen has experienced to the conflict, to the civil war.
Yeah. It reminds me, we did some interviews with some Karen in Minneapolis, where in Minnesota there's a big Karen community in the U.S. And Urban Village is a kind of a Karen community center that puts on a number of activities and initiatives, and they're speaking with the Karen there, and also those who run the Urban Village, they're describing this sense of third culture that a lot of Karen struggle with, because when they're in Minnesota and they tell people where they're from, you know, many people outside of Asia don't know where Burma is, and they certainly don't know the Karen. They hear Karen, they think, oh, Korea? Or they mishear it and they don't know it, and so they're having to describe a marginalized ethnicity in a country that itself is marginalized and left off the map in most people's perceptions. And so then when you're a marginalized community who's had to flee a country that you're not welcome due to violence and end up in a third country, that does lead to a lot of identity issues of who one is. And I've thought about this particularly with the Karen community, where you have a diaspora that is not just, as you say, not just spread across Thailand and Burma, and let's not forget the, you know, I think 100,000 or so refugees that are in the 9 camps along the border, many of whom have not just spent years or decades in those camps, but have actually grown up in those camps and don't know anything outside it. And then you have the Karen diaspora places around the world where it's kind of another dynamic to it. So, and within all of this is this sense of trauma for the lost Katule, you know, that as we're talking now, we're hearing that Manerpla might be falling back into Karen hands, which is incredible if things can start to shift in that direction. But you know, the fall of Manerpla in 1995 really just heightened this exodus. And so I imagine that navigating the Karen identity through all of these different geographic places, problems with poverty and asylum and refugee status, and the collective trauma being dealt with, I imagine this is something that really takes a lot of work.
Yes. That's true. I don't know where I belong, you know, like specifically, like with this, the Karen, the marginalized ethnicities, and then even the marginalized ethnicity is still different in Myanmar and Thailand, as I said. But, you know, I think, yes, I think we need to talk about it more, actually, you know, now that talking to you, actually, we just repress it, you know, we're like, when we think about it, it gets too complex, it gets too overwhelming, you know, like this and that, and there are a lot of trauma, and then, you know, and I know that the when we press this, also our body feels it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a lot of work to do in that sense. And I hope, you know, we could get through that at one day with bringing back the identity fully, and, you know, that we can like say it firmly, you know, that I belong to this, you know, this is the core of who I am, the identity, the Karen, or, you know, yeah.
Right. Yeah. You were talking about the anger that you first experienced when you learned the extent of the oppression and the years of persecution on the part of the Bamar military. And that's a through line that I've explored in conversations with other ethnics, is that young people growing up, and there's been several interviews we've done where people have said, you know, when I started to understand the extent of what was happened, all I wanted to do was just grab a gun and go on the front lines and defend my people and fight these Bamar that are coming in and doing this to us. And in several of those interviews, people have then gone on to talk about how they've channeled the anger, how they've understood the anger and worked with it, and then gone to be an academic or an activist or a lobbyist or someone that's trying to help their community in ways other than just the pure physical fight of it. And so for your part, I'm wondering, what nature did this anger take on when you started to feel it, and how did you work with it and then deal with it?
Yes, I think then I went to this migrant school in Mesot, and then we have like called Burma Studies, and this is was taught by this former politician, you know. He was also like he also went to like prison, if I remember correctly. So I think that's opened my eyes a lot, the Burma issues, what we're struggling, what we are fighting for, and the Karen, you know. And then because I was living in this migrant community, also I see how the immigrant workers community has to struggle in this oppression, also the discrimination, you know, in the Thailand, and how the struggle because of the economic. And then yeah, it makes me want to feel, I think my, that's when I thought like I wanted to tell stories, I wanted to tell the story of people, and I want, like, and then I thought of journalism, you know, and then that's what I was trying to go. And, but the thing is, when I was in uni, we didn't really learn about journalism. It's more of marketing or branding, you know, but that's the only subject that I can choose because of the scholarship, you know, not there are not a wider, subjects to choose from. And, but yeah, I was lucky enough to get the scholarship to do the studies, and then I realized I want a bit more of like a slow, soft storytelling. Mm. I think I wasn't really into like breaking news and things like that. And I realized if I'm gonna do journalism, maybe that's what I have to take on. I tried a few stories with when I interning. I was trying to intern with some news media. I really liked it, and maybe I was thinking of I want to do a bit more like features and stuff like that. So I started working for, because my goal was to stay to tell people's stories. So I started working with the BWF, and then we do a lot of field community stories, how them and the nature, you know, that they also work with a lot of Karen communities. So the Karen community also live with natures, and you know, how does it work with them, you know? Because I was, then my ideas changed to protecting the community and the nature, you know, as part of democracy, you know, for them to have the freedom to live with nature. Yeah, and then I really liked it, because that's the thing I wanted to do, because I was into taking visual stuff as well, you know, taking pictures and things like that. And then that's when the coup also happened, that I jump into illustrations when I feel like which one's more important, you know, like, because we couldn't do a lot of work anymore when the coup happened with the field work, you know, with the organization I worked with. That I jumped into illustrations because there was a need, and which makes me angrier see that it happened in our time, you know, that this state can happen. So yeah, I think so far for me it was just all about storytelling, and then and then with different formats, you know.
Right. So before the coup hit, after your university in Bangkok, you had gone back to Myanmar during the transition. As you said in your introduction, you wanted to be a part of this this positive change rolling through Burmese society, and to be a part of that, as many came from all over to live in the country during those transition years. And just taking a moment before you got into being an illustrator, before the pandemic and the coup, what was it like now coming back to Burma with the greater sophistication and understanding of the world and understanding the conflict, and being back in Yangon at that time and a greater awareness than when you were young?
Yeah, I think I was so motivated because I met a lot of like-minded people who came back, or who like the, you know, like you know, it's so empowering. Everybody wants to, like, everybody talks about politics, you know, the change that they want to make the country better, because we want that, you know. We want the people to be inclusive, and then to take care of us, our country, again, because we know that as a Myanmar person going other country, we know what it is like, you know, even go to Thailand, you know. The look on the face if you say you're from Myanmar, you know. And I think we just wanted to take pride again in the opening up, you know, take a chance to live like others, you know. And I think there were a lot of energy, you know, energy of wanted to do something good, wanted to be part of something good, and all the NGOs, organization who comes in also, like, to be, you know, to just lift it up again. But then also make us, at least me, realize that how fragile the democracy is. We couldn't take for granted, you know. That maybe sometimes makes me also think, like, maybe we didn't do enough work, like, to build that strong foundation, you know, that it can just one day go away, you know. So maybe for me, I did not understand politics enough as well, you know.
Well, you're a 20-something graduate. Is it the job of a 20-something graduate to solidify the democracy in our country strong enough so that a coup doesn't happen, you know? Yeah. It's this is Myanmar. It reminds me of what James Rodehaver said on our podcast after the earthquake, that the 7.7 magnitude earthquake that hit Mandalay, that it is not the job of normal civilians to go into an area of rubble and use their bare hands and clean it. This is the job of the state. It's not the job of a 20-something graduate to come back to her country and solidify democracy enough so that it's stable enough to prevent a brutal military takeover, you know. And this is, it's just so tragic hearing this, because you and so many people like you care so much about your country and your society in ways I don't see in other places around the world, where you want to, you know, you're so patriotic and wanting to come back and really make your country something to be proud of, so that it can stand by those other nations in the world. And the potential is there. We know it's there. And hearing this, I'm imagining this, like, you know, parallel trajectory of the coup not happening, and you and, you know, thousands of people like you doing your work day by day, month by month, and year by year, and this different Myanmar than we've ended up with now, where so many people are still alive. You know, just hold that for a moment. So many people have not been tortured and raped and killed. Mm-hmm.
and are continuing their professions, their ambitions, their passions, their which are serving them, but are also creating this growing civil society, inclusive society, hopefully, that is able to grow and to blossom. And all of this potential and these things that were there, you know, well, we know what happened. And now you and so many like you are now scattered around the world as the country devolves into what it is. And so it's, it's an important moment to reflect on, but it's just also very tragic to think of you and the many people like you that were there trying to make the society into something else with your passion and your dedication, and just the senseless brutality of what this military coup has devolved into.
It really is. We all have to reprogram our life again. You know, it's very, I think after the coup, life changed.
Yeah.
Like not in plan at all, you know, and then we have to pick ourselves again in new places, in new condition and new situation. And it's a lot of work, you know, so that we can still strong to resist the coup and, you know, the military, and while also picking up ourselves again when there are a lot of obstacles along the way, a lot of welcoming and it's not easy, you know, the path. Yeah.
No, it's not. Yeah. And so because there's been this thread of your own recognition of your anger and the role that played, I'm wondering also when the coup happened and the years after the coup, this anger that you had realized as a young person, you then had to work with and that drove you to be a storyteller. Did this anger come back again after 2021, and what form did it take?
Yeah, I was very angry. I was like, wow. I think the angriest thing was that realizing a lot of family will be scattered again, because my family did, you know. And I think I was very angry about that. Actually, at that time I had a boyfriend, and because of that, we're no longer together. But it's also made me realize that a lot of family would do that, and that it's so sad, because family should be together, you know, the people need to be together. And this, because of this coup, and I think that was my first reaction, that wow, a lot of like friends, family, we will be all over, you know, because this will go down. But not in a form where I was not picturing of like a lot of young people would go into the jungle and fight, you know. I just know that the economy would go down and the family will live apart again, you know. And then I was angry about that, but I was, and I think like a lot of people go on streets, you know, as aware, and we contribute in a lot of form we could, you know. And I think that time I just learned how to start doing illustrations, and then I was like, oh, a lot of people were like, you know, like also posting on social media on arts and stuff like that, and I think that was how I also channel it, you know. I took in an inspiration, and I'm like, to share online, and then I think that's how it's my illustrations like took place, actually, that I fully start grabbing on to fill in the gap for visual stuff, because I think it also become dangerous for photographers and journalists to get on the ground, took footages, So I saw the opportunity to fill in the gap, and I also want to contribute in some way, because I don't know how to do it otherwise, you know.
Right. So we're moving to your journey as an illustrator and learning illustrations, and realizing that at this time when the country's been taken away from you, and you need to find some way to resist and some way to use your special talents to contribute to the wider whole of wanting to protest against this military oppression, that you're turning to art, and in this particular case, illustration. And so Illustration means a big, it can mean a lot of things. There's a lot of different ways to illustrate. Tell us the type of illustration that you came to take on and what you wanted to do and portray with this illustration.
Yeah, I think I always like visual stuff, like for the journalism. And I like illustrations from like New York Times, and I don't know, it just gives me more. When you look at it, I don't know, it's just different, you know, when there is like a gift, it makes the story more alive and you understand a bit more even before reading the stories. So I was actually, when I tried to do illustrations, I think that's how I got inspiration from, and I wanted to learn how to do that. Not specifically thinking of become one, actually. It's just more like, oh, it was COVID-19. I'm like, I need to pick up a hobby, you know. Was bored at home. So I got myself an iPad, and then that's how I start learning. And I would say then, now that I work closely with journalists and organizations, so more on editorial illustrations. That means mostly on articles and reports and, you know, stories.
Right. Yeah. So that was how you got your start. Uh-huh. And then as you started to transition from what was hobby, a bit of a hobby, a bit of being bored, a bit of, we all had different ways of how we got through the pandemic. Some people baked sourdough every day. You know,
It didn't work out for me.
Didn't work out so well. Yeah.
I stopped, like, okay, not my thing, you know.
So your career as an illustrator was ahead of your career as a baker. So you took on you ended up doing illustration, and that continued. And then when the coup happened, you then had this skill to fall back on. But, you know, it's very different to create illustrations for an article where you have an assignment, or for a hobby where you're just diddling with something. This is now a life or death stake struggle with the fight for democracy and, you know, in very real terms, the friends that we all have on the ground that are in harm's way. So how did you use this new skill in this context of post-coup Myanmar?
Yes, I just saw that I need to channel my anger somewhere, you know, like protest was not available anymore. You know, we did everything we can. We hit the pan, you know, like everything, like silence, strike, right? Some people go to the jungle. Because for me, I was thinking, I'm not sure, you know, like, because for me, I know I want art. I want to keep doing the storytelling part, you know. That's my, also I think, my suited skill. So when my friend journalist reached out to me, then say, hey, we have this article, but we need visual, and I saw you posted art, so maybe we can work together, you know. I think that's how it started. I was like, I see the opportunity now to make my dream come true in a way, you know, that I always find this editor illustrations very inspiring. And I took it on. It was, I felt like it was my calling that time, you know. I find it also quite, you know, fulfilling, because I feel like the work that I was doing that back then, I didn't find it as fulfilling anymore, because I felt like this is more like urgency, you know, that can wait, you know. And also we couldn't really do anything anymore on the ground, so for the work, you know, for my job, and it was a lot of pauses, you know. So that's why as a citizen, you know, I see the urgency, so I jump into it, you know. And then I start to take it like fully, like, and that's how it got transcended, you know.
Yeah. Were you still in the country when you were making this protest art? And if so, did you ever feel unsafe with the work that you were doing?
I didn't really feel I felt safe. It's not like, because I was using my JC name, you know. I'm not sure, but it's not about that. It's more like them could catch you anything, anywhere, even if you walk down the street, you know? Yeah. It's more of that. And then if they look through your phone and they see this information, then it could be double, you know? Like, you probably would put in jail or maybe not get out. It was more of that. I don't find that they would, like, come to my door and knock on my door. It's more like if they're going to do, like, a check, like a family registration check, how many people live in this house, and they come in, they check, and they see some stuff, right? I think that's more dangerous to me. Mm-hmm. And, also, I think I had before actually leaving Myanmar, I have one experience where I got pulled over by a truck full of Myanmar police with rifles. They were like, I think my cousin turned the wrong turn, and then they were like, they thought it was some maybe PDF, you know, like, and then they were like running after us and said that, oh, we will shoot you if you don't pull over. And I froze because in my phone, I have communication with, you know, journalists on my work and things like that. And if they suspect us that we might have been PDF, because we're young, right? You know, so they could do anything, you know, and checking through phone. And I was like, oh, shoot, I would never leave this country again, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was just scared because I couldn't do anything, right? Once they capture you. But luckily, they were like, oh, if you were with other people, I think they were meaning like the soldiers, the military soldiers, we would have like been worse or like beaten up, you know. And they check and they let us go. And we were like saying, oh, yeah, it's just, you know, a wrong turn. Not because we saw you and we turn around, you know. It was just a wrong turn, so we turned back. And that was the experience where I felt like, It's not safe for anyone, you know, and not just because you are activist or you're like against them. You could be someone just make a little bit of a wrong something, and it's not going to be safe for you. You couldn't be beaten up or like put in jail, just doing anything.
Yeah, well, there's accounts of, you know, 17-year-old girls who have liked a Facebook post and gotten arrested for liking the wrong, literally for liking the wrong Facebook post, or that you wear a flower in your hair on a certain day, and or you wear a certain color on a certain day, and that's seen to be a support for the democracy movement, and that's enough to get you arrested or to get you questioned. And so, you know, it's you're right that it's not just a question of, I mean, this is the case in any dictatorship, really, is that this is how they use fear, is that whether you do or whether you don't, then you're still guilty, and the state still has the right to do whatever they want to you. And that was no more the case than, and continues to be that way, than in Myanmar, where, and especially as a young person, simply walking down the street is suspect enough.
Yeah.
So eventually you realized that you had to leave.
Yes, it was, it became, I also realized that when I was in Yangon, as I was young, I never knew about conflict, right? The civil war. Mm. And I was like, I don't want to live like that, you know? I don't want to, because I start to realize I'm like obeying their rules, you know? Because if you don't, you will get caught.
Yeah.
The fear slowly instilled in you. Mm. And I realized I don't want that. I don't want to live under fears and obeying them, you know. If I had a chance to leave, then I want to leave, you know. And still, I don't want to live. Yeah, I don't want them to instill fear in me. Because if I will live, then maybe I will live in fears. And I will not be able to speak up. I will live, you know. I will survive, but will be in fear. Like every movement, I will feel I don't have freedom. And I think I don't want that for myself, you know.
Yeah. I was I first started living in Myanmar in 2007, which was long before the transition happened. And it was my only time in life where I lived for an extended period in a society that wasn't free. And I was never at risk. I'm privileged, I'll be the first to admit that. So I was not, even though I was living in a non-free society, I wasn't personally at risk. For me, the greatest risk was that I was going to be deported and I could never come back, which I didn't want to happen. My life was there and my work was there and my friends were there. So I was trying, I was trying to behave in such a way that I wouldn't be deported. And living in a climate of fear where there's no freedom, one of the things that I would find in my mind, and I think this is something that you hear a lot in people who live in non-free countries, is the inner censor. That's how the states win, is that they don't have to censor you anymore because you have the inner censor, which is controlling. And I would find that when I was in a situation where I was having a conversation, I would want to say something. And I would realize that what I was about to say was maybe a little bit risky for that environment. Any other country is free speech, it's fine. But in that environment, it was a little risky. And I would find, I would feel like I would lose no matter what. If I went ahead and said the thing, I would feel like I was being risky, unsafe, like I'm taking chances. Why did I need to say this? There's no reason. I needed to put myself at risk by saying this. If I didn't say it, then wouldn't things just, you know, what do I really lose by that? If I did say the thing, then the next day I would feel guilty. I would feel like, why did I do this to myself? Why did I take this chance? I didn't need to say this. So I would realize that there was this line where there was no way to be in the middle of that line. I would either feel guilty for having said the thing or cowardly for having not said it. And that's how it got you. And so I'd be in these Gordian knots in the middle of conversations where I was constantly wrestling with myself if I should be courageous and say the thing, but then feel guilty because I'd put myself at risk, or if I should be cowardly and hold the thing in, and then I'm not talking and behaving too carefully. And it was, and I could only imagine the stakes for those who didn't have the kind of privileges as an outsider with a foreign passport would have.
Right. It's like a story I did for The Kite Tales. This woman wrote like, damn if you don't leave the country, and damn if you leave the country, you know? It's like there, you know? If you leave the country, and then it's like you have this guilt leaving.
Yeah.
But that if you don't leave, also, you are under them, you know? You also can't really do anything, you know? So I think, like, it's in the, that, you know, this or that, you know? Like, yeah.
Do you feel a sense of survivor's guilt having left?
Yeah, a lot. I think I try to not think about it sometimes, but it as also comes, like I live in my life and I forgot about, you know, what's going back home, because my reality is kind of here now.
Mm. Here in the Netherlands.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes. And then I would be like enjoying my time, and then would see news back home that people got killed or things got bombed, you know, and then I'll feel like, oh wow. And then the guilt comes in, you know, like, oh, what do I do, you know, like, how can I do this, you know, like, there's like an urgency again, you know, like, I try to talk to, like, people, you know, how do they survive, or like, hey, I have this guilt, you know, what do you do, you know, and I think we try to share each other guilt sometimes, you know, hey, how do you cope with it, you know, because part of you feel like you also need to live, you know, and part of you also feel like I don't deserve that, you know, because back home people are not living, you know, like I feel like I'm grateful that I can be here, but a lot of people cannot because of, it's just their situation, you know, and sometimes then you feel that guilt because maybe they need it more than you do. Yeah.
So how do you manage that?
Art, like my by doing illustration, I feel like I'm contributing, you know, I'm giving a voice to people that needed to be heard, you know, or the report. Also sometimes talking to friends, you know, I feel like I need someone to understand what I'm going through, or journaling, yeah, a lot of like these mindfulness practices, you know.
Right. I want to get into the art itself again, and because we're an audio medium, we have the disadvantage of not being able to show things to our listeners, but we definitely suggest they check out your artwork and check out your Instagram page, which will be linked to the show notes of this interview, because you can't really ever understand an artist's visual work until you actually see it. But because we're speaking right now, and we have the opportunity to describe it, I want to ask you if you can, for our listeners that maybe have never seen your work before, don't know your style or your artistic choices, if you can describe and give some impression or imagery as to what how your illustrations look.
Yes, I work mainly on digital, so all my works are on digital format, and I think whenever all my illustrations usually accompany with text, because I work close with the journalists and stories and organizations, so I need a brief or some form of text to accompany with, because more like to bring these stories to life visually. But I think I always try not to show the story literally. I try to balance it between the emotional part and the facts, you know. Because if I just show literally, then which a photo can do. And I think in illustration, that's the power you have. You can create in a way that would capture the emotion part as well. So I would say a bit of between, more of a conceptual way.
Your work seems minimalist to me. The colors are very inviting. The colors bring me into the story, and they seem to shape an indication of what the story could be, but it doesn't fill in all the details. It feels like it calls for some interaction with the audience or the viewer for me to want to bring in my background knowledge and myself into the details that you're not providing, if that makes sense.
Yes. I also want it to, to have a room to breathe, you know, not all that. I think sometimes maybe when I work with people, they want to include everything, right? Mm. And then maybe it's not really my style. I want to leave some room to breathe, you know. I want it to focus on some stuff. So yes, I think like also I wanted to relate it to the wider audience. So I feel like if I bring all the details, that it's too, maybe the wider audience could not capture what it's going on, you know? Let's say I try to, like the modern illustration, maybe some of the work right now, what's going on, you know? So it's also related to that. And then I also want to keep it in my style away. And these story all come from like a little bit of what I've experienced and then what I've witnessed, you know, and then the story. Yeah.
Mm, yeah. Right. There also seems to be something about it that's both personal and impersonal. That's seeming to have a subject that is an individual that's drawing you in, and yet there's something impersonal about that subject. And also I would say both kind of Myanmar and everywhere, you know, it's definitely grounding you in Myanmar, but there are also, you know, kind of blocky images that just could be anywhere. So I wonder if this is just the sense I get from it. I wonder if this is intentional on your part.
Yeah, because I think like for me, I grew up, like I think I moved a lot. So I think I pick up a lot of style in along the way, or a bit of cultures along the way. So I think like I'm not very grounded in the Burmese, how do I say, culture, you know? So that's why I also want to present that in my work, that a bit of personal, a bit of out there, you know, not confined only in this Myanmar culture. Because I think, like, then I want people to connect as well, you know. Because if it is, I want the someone not from Myanmar, they look at it, and even though they might not understand what's going on, they could feel something, you know. Yeah.
Have you, you know, that brings up an interesting part of storytelling, and you talked about at the beginning of our interview that storytelling was something, it was how you channeled your initial anger. It was you wanted to be a storyteller, and I think if there's one thing that Myanmar needs right now, tremendously, it's good storytelling, whether it's from activists or advocates or the NUG and the political members themselves. And perhaps you can make the argument that art is best suited for that storytelling ability. And so, and you just referenced how now you want to find some way you could bring the Myanmar story to those who don't know it and have them be able to come in and interact with it through your illustrations. And so are there comments that you've received that you can share from non-Myanmar people who are not so familiar with the Myanmar conflict that have found your illustrations, and through your illustrations have been the gateway for them to learn about the wider Myanmar? And are there some comments you've received as to how your illustrations were able to bring them into that story?
Yes, I would say so. I hope so. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing that I'm also not like interactive with people on on my social media, but yeah, I would say so. But I have like a lot of friends who never been to Myanmar and Burma, and then sometimes I also feel like I don't really like to talk about it, Myanmar, because I just want to, you know, I feel like a lot of things already for me involved in Myanmar, my work, you know, everyday news, right, like my community. So I think with my friends, even when they want to know, I would tell briefly, and then maybe when they see my work, then they would get to know more about mm-hmm. it, you know. Maybe they get more curious, mm-hmm. that they were like, oh, I want to know more about this, you know, what, how can I learn more, what kind of movie I can watch, something like that, or what kind of events can I come to, you know. Then I think it comes from through my work, some of them through my work, right, that maybe if it is only just the news, then they couldn't relate it as much, you know. If it is through artwork, then maybe that feels like, because art, it's everywhere, you know, and then maybe they could relate more, oh, this is what's happening, or there is this emotion here. The emotions are universal, you know, everyone has this sadness, loss, you know, revelation, and this love, right? And I think the art can do that, you know, the visual can do that, then provoke some emotions to lead to some curiosity.
Certainly. I'd like to prompt you to speak about one of your illustrations that stands out to you, something that you were really pleased with, that you thought brought a profound message, something that was difficult to work on, but some illustration we can use as an example through the process of creating it.
Yes. I think a lot of all my artwork, I would say they all important to me, because mm-hmm. it's not easy for me. It's heavy, you know. Every single time I read the story, it's like I have to. It's just not like, you know, like fun. Actually, a friend of mine said that. Do you ever do anything cute? I was like, no, I don't. You know, I don't do anything cute. It's all like part of like conflicts or, you know, loss and this thing. And then yeah, when he asked me that, I was like, good question, you know. Maybe I should do something cute so it's not always heavy, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I think when it's heavy, also sometimes I need a lot of break, because it can become exhausted, because I also want to capture the truth, you know, that dignify, not victimize, you know, because I don't like that, because I want it to, the people that gone through had some, they are people, you know.
Yeah.
They are, because of the military, it's that's their experience in this, you know. Nobody wants to become a refugee. Nobody wants to flee their home, you know. And they all have the dignity. They actually built their life, you know, to stay where they are. And back to your question. Which one? I think recently there was something I revisited again. Was about, actually I did for the Kite Tilt. It's about how the mother, like mothers have to go flee, and then especially the pregnant woman, they lose children, you know? And then actually that makes me, because I was looking through this because there was this exhibition about the gender violence, and then I need to submit some illustration to exhibits, and then that made me revisit that, because that story was also hard for me to make, because I couldn't get through the story, because it just me realizing how the woman has to go through this jungle fleeing in war and lost the twin, you know. And the twin is actually a good thing in Myanmar. If you pregnant with the twin, you're like, wow, you know, what a blessing, you know. So I think for her to lose twin, it must be hard. And that journalist was just who wrote the story, like explained this hardship. And then it also made me realize of the current fleeing the country. And I met this current refugees. They have to go through the hardship, you know, to when they give birth in the jungle, you know. And then that they have to come through all these. And it makes me so emotional, you know. And maybe also just being a woman, that how hard already it is to be a woman and flee, you know. And we have this periods and, you know, all the things that it's not safe to be in the jungle with, you know. It's not comfortable. And then there's plus you get pregnant, you have to give birth in the jungle where no hygiene essentials, you know. And that made me think about the babies, you know, that maybe they wanted it, you know. And then that connected to that, yeah, that was the hardest stories to do, because the losses of mothers. But I'm proud of the piece, because I think I don't show the mother as a victim, but who's someone who go through the hardship, you know, but also heavy feeling going through this. So I think I put some like a orange color at the background, and just in this darkness, you know, like walking through why being pregnant. But every piece is all important to me, you know, because they all in very special stories.
That's profound, and it makes me think of a couple of things. One is I'm thinking of our humanitarian mission of our organization, Better Burma, and one of the initiatives that we've worked on over the past years when you look at the IDP camps and those that are displaced and that are fleeing. Providing the usual, you know, medicine, food, shelter, et cetera, as we can, but then also the dignity kits to the young girls. And I think this is this is a modest culture. And having something that personal at that time of age, that is, you know, even in developed countries, can be an awkward or uncomfortable thing to talk about and to take care of. And with all of these conditions and all of this displacement, this is an added thing that if you're not female, then you're not aware of, or you might not be aware of this need that goes along with everything else. And especially when it comes along with these kind of cultural conditionings of discomfort and everything. And then when you're then on top of that, talking about pregnancy, talking about fleeing through jungles, it's, you know, it's a whole other layer, and it's something that I think is for females is obviously a consideration and a constant consideration, but being a man and for men with all the other things going on, sometimes we can forget about or not pay attention to, neglect all of those details that go with it. And it's so important to draw attention to that, and so important to support it through humanitarian efforts as well, to remember that part of it along with the food and the water and the shelter and the medicine and everything else. But it also, what you're saying also reminds me of a Bamar friend of mine who was a PDF and spent time with the KNU and the Karen, and was describing a moment where his perception really changed. And he was talking to someone in some village asking why they don't have their farms bigger, why they don't have trying to make schools that are more permanent and could have bigger class sizes and hospitals and the like. And the response was that as soon as we start to build something that's a little more permanent, a little bigger, we're just inviting the Bamar army to attack us. And so, you know, to think of a society, and again, not just now, but going back generations, to think of a society that is living over such a cloud of fear and terror and trauma, that if they're going to take more permanent steps to look after themselves and to provide services that are really going to help their community, that's actually going to make them a target, which is going to make them more likely to be hit and more likely to have loss. And so they're purposely not able to look at these long-term, more lasting solutions because that's more dangerous for them. You know, this is the definition of just a society that is completely unable, despite having the resources and the dedication and the service and everything else. But because of the terror being inflicted on them, they're unable to be able to look after one another and set up a society that is supportive because of this military shadow that's hanging over them. And that's been generational, that's been for years, but you know, in the years after the coup, it's in the story that you're describing, it's just a trauma that has now become exacerbated to, you know, acute levels of suffering.
Yeah, I cannot imagine that this will be years long, and then people need stability, you know, and then someone always have to flee. It's a lot of emotional burden. And then in that case, also need to make family, raise children, you know, on top of everything. Yeah.
Right. And so in this example you gave of this one story you illustrated, and this goes up for the other illustrations you do, you're reading a complex story with lots of context. Heavy. You say you don't work with cute stuff. This is heavy stuff that is drawing upon all of your personal resources to have to manage. And your job is to produce one generally minimalist illustration that's just giving this window or this sense into this incredibly emotional and moving story. So what's your process in wading through that complexity and just finding one window to bring the viewer into?
Yeah. I think I need to feel it, you know, like, and so it's so important to me that what I feel, and then it's also a lot of inspiration. I just don't want to, so it's complex, you know, just looking at that blank paper and then how do I put this together, right? It's not an easy process. I wish it just like, hey, create the story, you know. I think for me, I read other illustrators' work. I look at through other illustrator works who usually also work on this a bit more heavy stories and working on conflicts and how do they portray these heavy stories, you know? And I think I take inspiration from them, and then I look, and then, yeah, and also usually it's not always easy as well, because sometimes you feel like it's not, because nobody's really working on Burma, right? And it's sometimes it can be quite different as well. People maybe work more on like mental health stuff, or more like a lot of illustrators work on the US, so a lot of US issues. So not a lot on conflicts and, you know, how the refugee, and then especially the refugees from Southeast Asia or the developing countries like Myanmar. So I think I have to find the blend in there, like what is the mental or the emotions that I want to portray, but also bring from what I feel from this piece of stories and what elements I want to include, you know. Do I want to make sure that it's show that it's in the conflict, or it's the Karen woman, or it's an ethnic, or you know, so these pieces has to come through together.
I see. I imagine there must be a part of you that does look forward to a day where maybe you don't do cutesy art related to Burma, but you're able to do some type of art that doesn't have to be conflict-based. There's so much more in the culture that's so beautiful and so wonderful to share. And I imagine as an illustrator, sometimes you must really want to get to some of those parts of your culture and your people.
Yeah, maybe one day, you know. But I feel like every time I do a piece, I'm like, oh, I need a break, you know. Like, I need to do some other stuff, you know, like go live. But yeah, in the future, I want to do it because I think I also believe in news media, you know. I want the news media in Myanmar to develop and to reach one day, like, other international news media where we can also talk about culture stuff. We can also write about lifestyle, health, you know, how do we live, you know, nature, you know, a bit more, share a bit more about our culture in a lighter way, you know, than just conflict. But now the attention is going, and then we can also draw on like a bit happy stuff, you know, like culture, yeah, as you said, you know, a bit lighter stories to share, yeah. Mm.
So then, moving on with your journey, you left Myanmar sometime after the coup and ultimately found your way in France and now in Netherlands and Amsterdam, where we're talking now. Talk a bit, as far as you're able to and safe, about what brought you over to Europe and how your experience has been here.
Yeah, I would say it's not easy navigating immigration stuff, you know. Now I've been here in Europe for over 3 years now, and I'm still navigating immigration. I'm not settled yet at all. So I think that part, it's really taxing on my mental health sometimes, because part of me, I just want to be like settle and then move on and continue doing what I can do, you know. But also at the same time, I think it's I'm privileged enough to be here, you know. But also, I think living here makes me feel like I can participate in other awareness raising, you know, like from your stuff. Maybe me being here, the people that I connected to, I hope they can learn something about Myanmar. Yeah, because not a lot of people know about Myanmar. Whenever I speak to someone, they'd be like, where are you from? Myanmar. And then they'd be like, where? Beside Thailand. I was like, oh, Thailand. I was like, oh, beside Thailand. Yeah. Like, I literally need to pull a map and show them, you know? And then they're like, what you do? An illustrator. And then, oh, what do you illustrate? So, yeah, I hope asking me question, I hope they will also learn about Myanmar and something, you know, that maybe I could raise awareness even through a little bit of interaction. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And as far as you're able to share, what have you been doing in France and now Netherlands?
I just draw, you know. In France, I was in art school, so I was doing art, learn a little bit about art. But my family lives in the Netherlands, so I moved here. And then waiting for residency now, I've applied for asylum, so that also gave me a lot of limitation in terms of what I can do and what I cannot. But I still like drawing, I still do illustrations, but I would say less than the beginning, maybe because not in the beginning, it was a more like attention, right? Like a lot of news media, like, wanted to write about Myanmar, but maybe a bit less now. So, but whenever there is, then I will still do illustrations. Yes.
You referenced how, because you didn't just live in Burmese society, your illustrations also carry inspiration and influence from outside of Myanmar. And you referenced how you get some inspiration by looking at other illustrators who work on images for art based on articles. But I'm wondering if you have, because you do have this international sensibility and development, if there are other particular styles or artists that you were particularly influenced by.
I think I take from like every little things. I think also my illustration sometimes changes, depends on where like I want to. I think like when you look back my old illustration and my now, you can see the style may changed a bit. And to be honest, I don't have artistic skill. You know, like I did not learn, like, I don't know how to draw something realistic. But then this is also, I was not confident to become an illustrator in the beginning. But then when I study like other illustrators, it's not about knowing how to draw realistically. It's about how to bring ideas to visually, you know. So actually, it's not about drawing, but how your visual is showing, you know.
I see.
So I think, yeah, I don't really have particular illustrators that I have follow or like picked up on, but I always find something interesting in any illustrator. But I think mainly minimalistic and a bit some bold colors, or people worked on some stuff. I think maybe I can name some, maybe like Sarah Wong. I know that she gave me a lot of inspiration in her illustrations, bringing the emotions, complex emotions. And then there is like Santicon William. He's a Brazilian illustrator, but he passed away. I found out. I was so sad because I was actually like taking his class in like Domestika, and I was like, oh my god, he's so cool. And then everyone's like, yeah, he died, you know. Yeah. So I think I find the styles from different illustrators. Yes. And then also the limitation of my own skill, you know. Yeah. And then like there are things that they do that I'm like, no, I can't do that, you know. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, we talked about storytelling and about the role that art plays in it in general, and you've talked about how you have channeled your anger into producing art as a means of resistance. And so I want to ask you about what you feel the importance is of art as a medium, as a tool of protest, and as a means of resisting the military alongside, you know, actual weapons and diplomatic or political or advocacy or traditional grassroots activism. What is the unique ability and role that art plays in this?
Yeah, I think like art speaks to everyone, you know. I think you don't really need languages explanation, or you look, I think we're all surrounded by visual, you know, like art or that we don't even realize. So I think art is something very vivid for people, it can be very provoking, so I think, and it can show that what this person is feeling, you know. And I think for us to doing art in resistance can tell the world that we are not backing down, even though we might be trapped physically, but our emotions are not. You know, we are still angry. We are still resisting. We are sad. We lost things. You know, we're going through this. You know, so I think in art, it's a mean of a loud voice in a way that expressing when people far away cannot hear, or see, or witness. You know, and they can feel, or they can understand what the people feeling, what the people going through.
Right, and you referenced that you did illustrations for Kite Tales, among many others, but Kite Tales is quite a unique project, and we had Thin Le Win, as who's behind Kite Tales, we had her as a guest previous on our podcast. We invite listeners to check that out and hear her story and how that fits into Kite Tales. But for those listeners who haven't heard that, can you tell us what Kite Tales is and the nature of your involvement and how you felt about the project?
Yeah, I knew Matin like over 10 years ago, you know. She's amazing. And she was my boss back then when I was interning at her news media. And I think then the Kite Tales initially founded to, you know, travel through Myanmar, the culture that people have talked about, these unsung heroes, you know, these ordinary people stories. And I think it's quite ordinary that it's something needed in the country that people haven't established. And I think because of the coup, then they turned this project around because you can't really travel anymore. And then I think the Kite Tales step in to help to keep telling the story of the ordinary people who are fleeing and through the lens of journalists, you know. And because the Kite Tale is also in a way in an art form, so I wanted to use the illustrations as accompany the story. So I really like it because I feel like it also gave me opportunity to keep expressing as myself, an illustrator, and you know, as Myanmar, who have fled the coup, who is still resisting the coup in a way. Then, so I think it's something needed, you know, and to say, because it's not just like ordinary art news reports where facts and factual, and this is like a story, you know, it's very personal, and it's very emotion, full of emotion as well. It's like a little diaries, you know, it's like a diaries. You know, so like reading is, so it's, it's not like the news then, you know, like the typical news, So I think it just, you know, it's also good to, like, thanks you for giving me the space to share, you know. It's not only me sharing, because it's also made me reflect as well as an illustrator, like doing the work on Myanmar, because sometimes I just go and then don't really reflect, you know. And then this is also a chance for me to reflect as well.
Well, this is also storytelling.
true Yeah, exactly. So you know, and and then thank to also keep sharing and giving spotlight to Myanmar in different ways, different angles, right? Not just not just a specific group of fields or anything. As I mentioned, thanks for giving me a space to share. And then I think this, I will keep doing this for sure, but I'm not sure what would change in the future as I waiting for the residency and things like that. But I just want to say that, you know, I wish, don't forget about Myanmar. And then I will also try to do my best from here. And illustrations also, it's my way of connecting, and since I cannot be there physically, and it's a way of me to stay contributing.
I hope you enjoyed today's show. At Insight Myanmar Podcast, we're committed to keeping all of our content freely available so that anyone, anywhere, anytime can learn more about what's happening in Myanmar. But to continue to offer this product freely into the future, we need to find some pathway towards sustainability. And to this end, we've launched a unique line of merchandise that not only supports our mission, but also celebrates the incredible talent of contemporary Burmese artists. This online shop features a Burma-themed collection of t-shirts, hoodies, caps, bags, and more, all designed to reflect the culture and creativity of Myanmar. So we invite you to take a moment to explore the connection and find your new favorite piece by visiting the fundraising shop tab at betterburma.org and consider placing your order today. Together, we hope that we can make a difference while keeping this platform accessible to all into the future. And for those who are keen to give a donation, please do so by visiting insightmyanmar.org/donation for more information on how to help.
Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,